Hear that? It's the sound of you catching up on all the latest and greatest fintech news, trends, and updates thanks to Streetworthy, Yield Street's bi-weekly newsletter. Stay in the know with CEO Milind Mahiri as he takes a closer look at what's happening in the fintech space, then breaks down what each story could mean for investors like you. Give your portfolio the edge it deserves and subscribe to Streetworthy on LinkedIn today.
The Yield Disruptors, the biggest names in business, culture, and politics. Hear how successful influencers scored big and became the movers and shakers, pushing everything forward. Gain from their insight and advice, and avoid the setbacks that might keep you from achieving your true potential. Don't forget to rate us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and leave a review if you enjoy the content. This is the Yield Disruptors.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Yield Street's Disruptor Podcast, where we sit down with industry leaders and disruptors to discuss how they have reimagined and changed their industries and the leadership skills necessary to create new business opportunities. Today, I am very excited to be joined by Howard Lerman, my friend and someone that I know for 15 years almost now. And he is the founder and former CEO of Yext, a company that not only he founded, but took public and at a multi-unicorn valuation. So really excited to chat with Howard and really talk about his journey and what we could learn from him. So Howard, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Milind. Good to see you. You look amazing. You look younger every time I see you. So whatever you're taking, let me know.
All right, will do. So Howard, let's start by maybe just give our audience a little background on you and Yext and what prompted you to start Yext.
Well, it's funny with entrepreneurship. Everyone's always, the press likes to focus on the light bulb moment, the eureka, sort of flash of brilliant insight that you have to start a company. And frankly, with Yext, I think that's more of a story of just chipping away with having perseverance to attack kind of an area and an opportunity over a long period of time. There was no eureka moment. And, but taking a step back, like, I think when I was, it has become cool to be an entrepreneur today, right? Like everybody, Silicon Valley makes it glamorous and it infiltrated Hollywood. It became cool. Now it's cool to be an angel investor, right? I think I am, and I think you might be the same way, Milind. Like, I like to think of myself a little old school. I would have been an entrepreneur in the 80s. I would have been an entrepreneur in the 1700s. I would have been building shipping businesses or something. I always knew I was going to do sort of something different. And I knew that, and if you think about what entrepreneurship is, it's seeing opportunities and seeking change and affecting that change with ingenuity and brute force and whatever the hell it takes to get it, to kind of get it done. So I was kind of, when I was a kid, I always felt a little different, always felt a little sort of at a different wavelength than some of the other people. And, the luckiest moment of my life was when I grew up a half Jewish fat kid in a red state that sang opera. And my mom used to come and pick me up after baseball practice to take me to opera practice. And let me tell you, you got the shit kicked out of you for that. And I think that made me tough. But the sort of key moment of my life was when I got into a STEM high school, science, technology, engineering, math, called Thomas Jefferson High School for Science and Technology in Virginia. And, these STEM high schools are tremendous because they're free. They're public schools. And the way you get in is not by knowing somebody. It's not by having more money. It's literally just you take the test. And the most qualified lovers of STEM are accepted. And that is the ultimate meritocracy. And so I got into this school, and some of the most brilliant people, my classmates have gone on to, and one of my classmates started this company called FoundationDB, which is a disconnected data access database layer that Apple acquired and now powers parts of, the iCloud interface. And the point is that, I was surrounded by all these, brilliant people kind of at like the right time in the late 90s, early 2000s, mm-hmm. in high school and in college. And, you know, that was just kind of a good time to start companies. And the cool thing about going to TJ and later Duke, but especially TJ, was you met people who were capable of doing stuff. And it was funny because the people that were 16, 17 in high school that were into engineering and programming and coding could do stuff that like 40-year-old adults couldn't do and knew nothing about. And so we brought something to the table.
Right.
And so we'd bring this like, oh, we can, you want a website? We can make a website. Like adults would be like, whoa, at the time in, you know, in 1999, very few people knew how to make a website, but we did. And so, so I started my first company at Duke when I was a sophomore. I sold it when I was a junior, and you know, all the advice in the world said that you wanted to be a doctor or a lawyer or a consultant or go into finance and whatever. And I just sort of didn't ever take any of that seriously at all. And was fortunate to be, have met at an early age, people who shared a passion for technology and building things. So we started our, you know, I started a company, like I told you, when I was a sophomore, and then right out of college, I started another company, and then Yext came along. And, you know, I started Yext in 2006 and took it public in 2017. Five years later, I stepped back and passed the torch about a quarter ago. It's funny, last week was the first quarter in 5 years that I hadn't had an earnings call and hadn't sat through pre-audit committee calls and all that stuff to make sure it was all good. But I think, you know, the story of Yext is one of just sort of attacking an opportunity. It's a space you know well, obviously, through your foundership of Yodel, but it's simply a story of bunch of really smart, talented people attacking a huge opportunity and chipping away at it over a long period of time. We never, nothing was ever easy. Everything was earned every step along the way.
So, Howard, tell us a little bit about what was that opportunity and why was it disruptive at the time when you started Yext and, you know, I started Yodel 2006, you know, Google had just gone public, you know, was a small company, if we can believe that world. So tell us a little bit about that.
You know, it's funny. When I started Yext in 2006, it wasn't Yext and it looked nothing like the Yext of today. It was a lead generation service for gyms with a consumer property called gymticket.com.
Yeah.
And it let you go to this website and request a free trial pass from a nearest health club. Yeah. And, you know, the idea, my vision was to build a hotels.com for gyms. And it, you know, and I, what I did when I founded the company, I went and I got the founder of the Trade Association for Health Clubs, this guy by the name of Rick Caro. He at the time must have been 150 years old. Today is 250 years old and, you know, was connected to every gym. So, you know, the founder of the trade organization, the trade organization, introducing you to CEOs of Anytime Fitness and, you know, at the time Bally Fitness and, you know, all these big gym companies, 24 Hour Fitness. And so we signed them all up and sent them leads. And, you know, we would arbitrage paid search and buy paid search. And we got it to like a few million dollars of revenue. And like on this lead gen thing, we charged per lead. And then like, we were like, okay, like what's next? Because that was like the whole TAM for like the gym search was like a few million bucks. So we then went into veterinarians and then we found that they didn't want leads. They wanted phone calls. We built this whole call tracking system and you know all about that. And then we built the ability to analyze the call and look for keywords in the call. And then around 2010, 2009, Google approached us and said, hey, we want to take a look at buying the company. We're like, okay, well, gosh, you're Google. That's incredible. So we, you know, sort of went down an M&A path with them, which ultimately broke at the last minute. And like, at this point I was sort of faced with a huge choice. I had a $20 million lead generation business with, you know, paid search arbitrage to companies. And sort of in setting up all these track phone numbers, I had realized that you could hijack someone's Google listing and put a number in there, even if you didn't really know the business. And that's sort of an evil trick. And I recognized that, well, wait a minute, like there's gonna be a way, the companies are gonna wanna clamp down on their information. And so that's where the whole idea of business listings synchronized came from. And over time, you know, so I had this new model, but I also had this pay-per-call advertising model. So we ended up selling the ad business to IAC. And we then built this sort of listing synchronization product, and that was a home run. The kind of recognition, it was a simple, you know, sometimes the best ideas are the ones that you're like, how come no one else has thought of that? And just sort of synchronizing phone numbers and addresses and business information across Google and Alexa and Siri and Apple, like that turned out to be a home run idea. And, you know, behind that became the knowledge graph and sort of the, you know, Yext sort of grew out of that. We partnered with Yodel, of course, along the way, and other companies that wanted to synchronize business information. That was the sort of, I guess, the light bulb moment was when we realized we could hijack a Google listing, and we knew that companies would want to protect it.
Yeah. So even though, Howard, you had a light bulb moment, obviously there was Google Maps, Verizon, lots of Yellow Pages companies that own those listings, right? And so when you are creating this type of disruptions, what were the early days like? And I remember I was, you know, when you explained to me this new shift in strategy, I was one of the first people to partner with you from a Yodel perspective, because we thought that it would be amazing, especially for our franchise business that have 50 locations but no standardization. Yep. So for our audience, just in 3 seconds, Yext, what they did is, if you are McDonald's or you are a big franchise, how do you have consistency in your listing? And also, you have to remember, this is 12 years ago, okay? Google Maps was not as sophisticated as it is today. So what Howard was doing was really trying to create that synchrony so that you can really track customers from clicking all the way to calls. And so obviously there were all these existing incumbents going after the, you know, like a similar market. What did you say to the naysayers? How did you say that, hey, this is what I'm going to continue doing? And I remember very quickly in 12, 18 months, you had 20, 30, 40 properties where you're synchronizing data and like driving consistency. So tell us a little bit about that.
There was this legacy company called LocalEase. Yeah. And they did kind of what we were doing manually. And they had this terrible model where they would charge companies for the data, but also charge companies to update their data, which I just found to be morally incongruent, because how can you represent a complete data set to, say, Yahoo, if you charge a company to update their data? Right. It's sort of a reverse Chinese finger trap.
Yeah.
I took a lot of issue with that, and they hated us. I remember their people used to mock us at conferences. They used to try to interrupt me during keynotes. But I can safely say we fucking destroyed them. And, you know, the way we did that was by building up, this is a perfect example of just technology dominating. I mean, we built up a next generation system to automatically synchronize business information on a network in real time. And it just sort of stunned the entire industry and literally was 10 times better than anything else out there. So we were able to grab all that market share and became kind of like a necessary tool for anybody that wants to, for any business that wants to sync their information and cares about their presence in a core part of search. But, you know, kind of in the early days, my God, it was hard. You know, we had to get Yahoo and big companies to install these, you know, to hook up with our APIs, which was hard. Like, it's hard to get Yahoo to change their SERP. You know, that's a sacred kind of thing. And then, you know, when we started, we didn't have Google. We didn't get Google until 2015. It took 5 years to get Google. It took, and me pounding at the door, we were like a million locations before we ever got to Google. So it was hard. It was not easy. And there was a lot of doubters along the way. But ultimately, I had this team of people that we believed in. And we knew that this was the kind of thing that should exist in the world. And that tends to win out over the long run.
Yeah, makes sense. So you spoke about technology. So tell our audience a little bit about the role of kind of AI and technology itself in automating this process that, you know, obviously outside looking in should be very simple and people should maintain their own listings. But because the web is so proliferated across different directories, channels, listings, tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, you know, if you think about the math problem of your McDonald's and you have 20,000 locations and each location has 200 data points in each data point, and then there's 200 different places where that data needs to be synced, and also on average, the average data point changes once per quarter. There's a lot of math there, and that becomes a big data problem pretty fast. We use AI in lots of different ways to help with matching listings, which is a huge problem. We use AI to help. Well, now Yext is a great AI product that helps give answers directly with our search product. And, you know, if you think about the foundational changes happening in search, talk about that for a minute. I mean, search went from blue links on a page using, you know, traditional index-based keyword search that just literally looked for a string that matched like what you look for, like think of Google 99 and give you like links back to natural language understanding, where they don't, you know, give you links anymore. They just like kind of give you the answer, like, and they try to understand what you're looking for. They use the database called the Knowledge Graph, which contains a database of everything they know about the world and their connections, to answer these questions, to parse your natural language query, to be able to give you an answer back. And that fundamental change in search in many ways enabled Yext, because in order for Google Maps to give you a really good answer, Apple Maps to give you a really good answer, they have to have the data.
Right.
And who's the ultimate authority on, you know, what time the McDonald's on 21st Street is open? It's McDonald's.
Yes.
So that was always the premise of the company. And companies would put their first party information out in an unstructured way on a website. And then company, you know, Google and others crawl that and they try to interpret it. But it's easier to just say, wait a minute, here it is in a structured way in the first place. Because it started structured, it became unstructured, you interpret it, then you restructure it, you might as well just shortcut the whole process and just give it to, you know, the search engine structured way.
Right. And also for discrete information like how you had, that was a much smarter way to do it. Where it's where, you know, NLP and contextualizing helps it, because, you know, when you really have unstructured questions. But this needs to have not only precise answer to save you time and effort, but also this is a problem that discrete that you know you can really solve. So really, you know, incredible what you guys were able to do. And I still remember, I don't know what the right number was, but I think last time, this was probably 7-8 years ago, I remember you saying we are optimizing 800 million locations or something, 800 million data points or something like that. That was like pretty cool.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. Tons of data. I think we really helped Apple Maps get better pretty fast, because they had some challenges, as you may recall, when they first launched and people were, you know, driving to locations that don't exist and stuff. But I think it's good for the world to have kind of an independent database of all the locations that's first party supplied for a company. And, you know, I think, you know, I can't speak for the company anymore as I'm, you know, no longer there, but I think that their vision and mission of helping put perfect answers everywhere is still going to be around for a while, from what I can tell.
So speaking while on the subject of AI, you know, what do you think is going to be the future of AI, especially over the weekend? You know, there was this news about sentient, and Google engineer putting something out. So what's your broad view with singularity? And those things have been swirling for last 10 years, but like, what's your view? Where do you see it go in the next 10, 20 years?
You see the demo a few years back where Sundar was showing this sort of telemarketing call from the Google bot to a spa to book an appointment.
Yeah.
And this bot basically just totally effed with the person it was talking with. They even included like an like, you know, hi, I'd like to book an appointment, and totally just duped the person they were talking to. In my mind, that was one of the most, now I'm sure it was canned and they picked one of many, but it was one of the most impressive demos I'd seen technically since the iPhone launch, really.
Yeah.
And I think Google made, you know, they got some backlash from that. And now they're careful to control the fact that their AI is not too good. Like that, you know, the guy that's saying that the being is sentient, you know, he's on paid leave now. I don't know if you noticed that.
Yeah.
Like, so you wonder what they show you and what they don't show you. Because I think they showed this bot messing with this poor spa salon receptionist, and now they don't show that kind of stuff anymore. I guess my point is, you know, I think I can't speak to the singularity, but I can certainly speak to the fact that conversational AI is pretty good, and I think in 10 years it's gonna be really good. I don't know enough about consciousness to say if something was conscious or not. That's like a metaphysical question. But at the same time, there's still, like, when you look at like GPT-3 and GPT-4, where like they have these really advanced models, like read the internet, and then, you know, they'll give it a name and they'll say, okay, give a speech from, you know, XYZ person, like, you know, give a speech from Joe Biden or Donald Trump or Barack Obama or whatever. And the stuff that comes out, it's still garbage.
Right.
Is a computer gonna make a Picasso? I don't know, but could they make art that looks like the Picasso? Yes.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, I think there are interesting developments obviously always happening. And if you take anything from Boston Dynamics to things that you see in movies, like there is always 10, 20, 30 year lag, but I think, yeah, we are far away from singularity, I would suspect.
We have some other stuff to figure out before we get there.
I would agree with that. So, moving on, you obviously, all of us kind of were part of this movement to like really put local advertising on the map and like just take ad tech to the next level. And lots of us started at the same time, whether it was Yodel, Constant Contact, Angie's List, HubSpot, even a company like Shopify, you know, that was started in 2010. You obviously had an amazingly successful outcome. Talk to our audience a little bit about the IPO process and, you know, kind of taking the company public in this disruptive environment with a multi-billion dollar IPO.
Yeah, I mean, the first thing we do is we brought in a CFO, Steve Cape Red, who had taken Salesforce public and Pandora public. So they, 2 years ahead of time, begin to kind of get the company IPO ready. Mm-hmm. One just sort of technical point is a unicorn, by definition, is a $1 billion private company. We never were that.
Yeah.
We had a $500 million valuation before we went public, and then we went public at above $1 billion. But by the time we're public, I think we're technically not a unicorn, which was by design because we just didn't see the point of like having huge private company valuations that you then have to live up to unless you have need for extraordinary amounts of capital to grow fast.
Yep.
So, you know, we were always, and if you look to, you know, even today, you know, Yext has, had a pretty good quarter last quarter, and, you know, you can see their cash flow positive. And so that's always been a focus of us, of ours.
Yeah.
So you bring in the CFO, they get the company IPO ready. And honestly, you kind of go along for the ride. They, you know, if you have an experienced CFO, they do it, and you show up and you do a million meetings and you talk about your baby. But that's kind of easy to do because it's like a professor talking about their own book. You know, I've been building Yext for 15 years. It was easy to talk about it in front of investors and convince them about why we're going to grow and how big we can be. And, you know, and then Steve would answer all the technical questions. But the process itself was a 2-week roadshow where, you know, you have 8 meetings a day with bankers, and it's pretty insane because you're flying around different city every night. The bank rents you like a private jet, which was pretty crazy. And then you're, you know, sitting there with, you know, different hotels and different nights, and you just sort of fall through the process.
Yep.
And then it culminates in a day where you bring your whole company together and you celebrate it. It was an extraordinary achievement and something that, you know, we were, you know, it's one of the most proud things I've ever done in my life. And, but then you're public and then, you know, every quarter you're accountable, and it really does change a company to be looking at your quarterly results as opposed to kind of longer term stuff.
Yep. So really, I think, Howard, you made some 2 or 3 very important points that all the listeners should take away from. One is to ensure that don't get caught in the frenzy of valuation as a private company CEO or a management team member. Only raise capital when you need. So it's very important to be capital efficient. And lastly, IPO, in my opinion, and I'm sure that's what I heard from you, is just a milestone in the evolution of the company. And, obviously you need to have a fundamentally strong business and revenue model for you to be able to even get on that private jet and do those meetings and for people to hear you. So amazing thoughts there, Howard. So talk to us a little bit as we kind of wind this down. There are lots of founders, right? And they all obviously think that they are disruptors, but they are disrupting something. You've been a multiple founder, you know, really taken this company to huge heights. What are some of the traits that or challenges that founders should watch out for as their company is scaling?
Well, I think it depends a lot on the sort of stage in the company. I mean, when you hit 150 people, that's when you can't know everybody and their story, despite how hard you may try as a founder. But, you know, you want to hit that escape velocity. you don't want to get caught up in the bullshit. It's very easy to be a founder and think it's cool to be a founder and forget to do the nitty gritty that actually makes the company go. I think today's founders, as a general rule of thumb, have far too much, this is not for everyone, it's a generalization, but they have far too much focus on their own stock price of a private company. And I understand that because a lot of people are doing this for the reason of, you know, making money off a stock price or a stock sale, and their employees are focused on it. But over fixation on stock price and valuations and maximizing valuations can be toxic to a growth company. I think you're going to definitely see that, and you are seeing that now in the private markets for many companies that have raised huge amounts of capital at sky-high valuations. They're going to be faced with down rounds or terms or preferences and that kind of stuff, you know, as they go to get more company, more money. And the other point is, I'm not even sure for a company always, and this isn't universal, and nothing I say is universal, but it's not always better to have more capital. Right. Yeah. Stupid on small things, stupid on big things. Correct. Sometimes.
That's a great point. So how do we be capital efficient, want to make sure that you have a product that hits escape velocity? And obviously all of us are humans, so we think about the value that we are creating in the world, but stock price always, or valuation always, is not the indication of the value. I always say, I read it in a book called Go Giver, where, you know, there's this law of compensation. Law of compensation is proportional to the value that you create or the lives that you touch. And so it doesn't apply to hedge fund guys, but if you think about like the biggest, you know, wealthiest billionaires, they're touching hundreds of millions of people, right? And so they're, you know, they're just compensation and net worth because they're creating that much value. So all of us as founders and entrepreneurs need to be focused on that. However, it was amazing to talk to you. What's next? What's next after this massive 15, 17 year run for you? I know that you're always doing innovative things. In between that, you sold a nice email company also. Signal, was it called?
Confide.
Yep.
That's right.
So tell us what's next.
Milan, without getting too much into the details of what's next, I can tell you that I'm the kind of person that doesn't like to be an investor.
Yeah.
But just me. I'd like to be in the arena.
Yeah.
And I will be jumping back into the arena with a breakthrough new company I've been working on for 2 years, and I am fired up about it. So you'll just have to tune in next time to learn more about that company.
Okay, fair enough. And I have to tell our audience that I've had a sneak peek at it, and I'm also as excited as Howard, and really want to be one of the pilot customers. So there you have it, awesome. Folks. Howard Lerman, founder and former CEO of Yext. And thank you for joining us today. And thanks again for all of you who have tuned in on the Yield Street Disruptors podcast. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of The Yield. For the latest updates on the alternative investing space, go to yieldstreet.com. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. If you enjoyed the show, feel free to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, as this will help other investors like yourself find our show. If you have any questions, please visit us at yieldstreet.com. Thanks again for listening, and see you next week. The Yield Street podcast you just heard only reflects the opinions of the host, who is an associated person of Yield Street, and does not necessarily reflect the views of Yield Street or any of its affiliates or other associates. The podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to be and should not be construed as a recommendation to buy or sell any security, and is not an offer or sale of any securities or investment product. The podcast is also not a research report and is not intended to be and should not be construed as investment advice.
Support for this podcast comes from Yield Street. Trying to time the stock market can lead to regret. At Yield Street, our alternative investments are designed to create predictable secondary income streams, providing you with tools to help put your money to work immediately. These investments in asset classes like art, real estate, and legal finance typically have low correlation with the stock market and target annual yields up to 7 to 10%. Welcome to the next generation of investing. Welcome to Yield Street. Sign up today at yieldstreet.com.